I'm delighted to have with me Barry Cryer, OBE. Good afternoon, Barry.
Hello, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. How are you?
Last time I looked, I was fine.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it. Great pleasure to speak with you. Bit of a legend, Barry. But you've written practically for every comedian, past and present, in the country.
Well, we all did. I've got an inflated reputation. I've got a load of mates. We all wrote for everybody in those days. And I think I've got a higher profile than my mates because of the performing. You know what I mean?
But yes.
A lot of my friends, we all wrote around for everybody.
Yes, definitely. I mean, the list is endless. Bob Hope to Bruce Forsyth, Tommy Cooper to Dick Emery. Now, if I have this right, by your own admission, you call yourself a gag man and you like working with writing partners to construct things, and that's really worked the best for you. What do you think's the key to a great writing partnership?
It's like any relationship. You don't know until you find it. It's the chemistry. Mm. You just don't know. And if you have a mental block and you're working on your own, we've all found this, anybody would say, in any business, you know, you're in trouble. But if you've got somebody with you, you can start kicking the ideas about.
Yes.
So I invariably wrote in partnership, yeah.
Yes, very.
Somebody on my list, one of the happiest times of my writing was Kenny Everett, who wasn't a comedian. He was Kenny Everett. He was the only non-comedian I ever wrote for. And that was a very happy time. And the man I wrote with for Kenny Everett was called Ray Cameron. Sounded late Ray Cameron. The father of Mike McIntyre.
Yeah.
So the generations go on. I knew Mike when he was a little boy.
It's amazing, isn't it? It obviously runs in the family, that one. But, I mean, very often, like you say, all kinds of ways of coming up with sketches come about and you bounce off a partner. It's obviously crucial. I love the fact that you and your long-term writing partner, John Junkin, would act out the respective parts from Morecambe and Wise, John playing Eric and you Ernie. Did you find this helped you? With all sorts of nuances and
Dennis
things.
Dennis Norden, the great guru, my old friend, said, now it's the laptop and everything. In those days, it was a typewriter or scribbling. Dennis said, there's always a sitter and a walker. One of us just sitting at the table, trying to get it all down. And John Junkin used to walk round the room, twiddling his glasses, being Eric Morecambe.
Yeah.
You're like a tailor making suits, you know, you try and match the personality and the way they talk and the way they move. And you've got them in your mind's eye when you're writing for them.
Absolutely. Did you sort of think of the nuances and the pauses they might affect when they played your words? Why do you think it was that Morecambe and Wise made them so accessible to millions of people?
Well, they were made for television. I saw them many years ago when they were starting, and they were a sort of imitation of an act called Abbott and Costello, American film comedians.
Yes, I remember.
They were very orthodox. Ernie was a straight man. Ernie used to smack Eric's face. And then the great Eddie Braben came along. I always say he was the 18. John Junkin and I wrote a lot for them, but I always say Eddie was the man. He changed their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Ernie became the pompous playwright, and they were both funny in the finish.
Mm.
And a lot of the old musical comedians were too big for television. They behaved as if they were still on the stage. Eric
yes.
and Ernie were just chatting. They were made for television, and television found them, thank goodness.
Absolutely, yeah. Everybody has a favourite Morecambe and Wise sketch. I mean, my personal favourite's Andre Previn. So many big stars of the day appeared on Morecambe and Wise, didn't they? Of all the stars that appeared, who were the most difficult to get on in the first place, and who were you most surprised
well,
to finally see on?
Well, I can't remember when the gear change came, because they were queuing up to be on it.
Mm.
They had very few. If they did, I didn't hear about them. They had very few refusals from anybody.
Yes.
Everybody wanted to know about it from the word go, because it was something entirely different for actors and actresses and star singers and everything. They were intrigued that they would go on, not be insulted, but played around with.
Yes.
You know, Shirley Bassey with big boots on. And it was it was a joy. Oh,
yes.
No, they were all queuing up to be on.
Absolutely. Angela Rippon, who can forget?
Yes, indeed. Well, John Junkin, actually, I think Eric came up with the idea we ought to have Angela on. She dances. And John Junkin came up with the idea of Newsreader talking about the Chancellor at Exchequer, who said there may be trouble ahead. So maybe moonlight and love and romance. And the desk split open and she started dancing about.
Classic. Really is brilliant. What do you think creates TV magic?
Well, you can't define it. Because I can't tell you is why it happens. Somebody's on the screen
True.
And you know that's it. Like we said about Eric and Ernie, you know.
Yes.
They're just on. And there's a lot of talent around now. I hate people of my age and not the young ones. I mean, Ross Noble. Oh, boy.
Mm.
And Bill Bailey.
Oh, yes.
and Stuart Lee. There's some brilliant talent around now.
Absolutely, there really is. And of course, being nostalgic and going back once again, though, but many Python fans will know that Graham Chapman and John Cleese worked extensively together, but they may not know that you also wrote with Graham. Which sketches did you write together, and did you have a personal favourite?
Well, we wrote shows. We wrote early Ronnie Corbett sitcoms before he did Sorry. And then we worked on other shows in the old days, so the Billy Cotton Band show. We wrote for The Serious Doctor in the House. I wrote more with Graham outside Python than anybody.
You are, and the Four Yorkshiremen sketch was a moment of sort of TV genius, and you were the waiter in part of that famous sketch. Being a Yorkshire man, born and bred in Leeds, did the sketch make you laugh, and did you write any of it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I loved it. It was born before Python. It was way, way back, and it was in a show called At Last, the 1948 Show. It's regarded as a Monty Python sketch, which it subsequently was, but that isn't where it started.
Yeah. All right. Early days. This is the one, if I'm right in thinking, where they're all topping each other with it were grim. But it's
lived in a hole in the road and all that stuff.
Yes. Brilliant sketch. Wonderful. And of course, so many memorable sketches came out of the Frost Report, including the famous class sketch. I'm sure you'd agree few can top the two Ronnies in terms of a great partnership.
Yeah.
You must have been asked 100 times, about the fork handles.
A man called John Law, I always mention.
Yes.
Because people say, oh, Ronnie Barker wrote that or somebody else wrote that. John Law, brilliant man, wrote the class sketch.
Yeah, so enduring, isn't it? So relevant to today as well.
And the two Ronnies had the chemistry. You could see it on the screen. I was there when they first got together on a Frost show, and very soon you thought, oh, this is meant to be.
It's a wonderfully enduring partnership, wasn't it? And, I mean, what's your enduringly favourite sketch of theirs? Did you enjoy collaborating on any the most?
Yeah, one I didn't write, written by a friend of mine called Colin Bostock-Smith, and you hardly ever see it now. Ronnie Corbett and Ronnie Barker have been playing squash. And Ronnie Corbett comes into the changing room, covered in sweat and red in the face with a headband on, furious, because he's been playing with this amateur. And Ronnie Barker comes in, carrying a cricket bat and wearing cycle clips. And that's all it is, the conversation. Corbett, furious, has just been beaten by this amateur.
No.
It was a superb sketch.
Oh, it's the way they do it together as well, isn't it? The physical.
And the laundry chute in the hotel, when Ronnie Corbett comes down the chute. I was involved in writing that, and I can't remember which partner it was.
Oh.
Maybe David Nobbs.
Oh, yes, David Nobbs, Reginald Perrin.
Down the chute in the hotel basement.
Oh, you've worked with some brilliant people. It must have been hugely satisfying to work with these people. But, of course, you said in your book that you never be fazed by rejection, as one day you can always bring that material out again. Perhaps you could tell us the story of the writer who took an old sketch he wrote for Tommy Cooper and presented it to Dick Emery. Nearly got away with it.
Yeah, Dick rang the writer up and said, we've got a gap in the show next week. We need another sketch. And the writer took this one out that he'd written for Tommy Cooper and thought, well, that would fit Dick. And he gave it to somebody to type up and said, where it says Tommy, put Dick. That'll be all right. And he looked at it. Yeah, I'll send it off to Dick Emery. Dick rang him up and said, I don't want your Tommy Cooper rejects. So the writer blustered and bluffed and said, what do you mean? He said, well, it's very funny, he said, but on the last page it says, Dick gives his characteristic laugh and his fez falls off.
No.
Bit of a giveaway, I think.
I think so, yes. He almost got away with it, didn't he? Such a shame. Now, of course, I remember meeting Dennis Kirkland, Benny Hill's producer, when I worked for a TV company in Teddington, and the word heyday was a word that came up quite regular. Now, you've worked with Benny Hill and Morecambe and Wise in their heyday, if you like. What do you think it was meant in terms of the TV heyday and what not so prevalent today?
Well, people were talking about the golden age, and it was a pretty rich age, what was going on, Tommy Cooper, Frankie Howard, Eric and Ernie. But I'm very suspicious, I'm very wary of that. Getting old, you know, of saying, oh, we had the best of it, because, as I said before, every generation's got marvellous stuff going on. It was a good time to be around that. I wouldn't have missed it for anything. But I like talking about the past. I don't want to live there.
Yes. There's a difference, isn't there, though?
Yeah.
It's appreciating the supreme talent, though. I mean, you can't deny that. I mean, you've said you never wanted to be the star. You don't feel you had the X factor. But and you cite some good ones, as you call it, Spike Milligan, Tony Hancock, Peter Cook, a sort of air of self-destructive madness, you know, Freddie Starr and Kenny Everett. Were there any examples
creative
you could cite?
Madness.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Were there any examples you could cite when they actually scared you a little?
Spike could. And Peter Sellers. Oh, boy. Spike once said, Harry Seacombe's pretending to be mad. Peter and I are the real thing. Spiked up one day and down the next. You know, when he was bipolar, you had to make allowances, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was the problem there, so he had to try and cope.
I see. So it must have been very very unsettling. And with people like, you mentioned at the start, Kenny Everett and Freddie Starr. I mean, did they kind of set you on edge? Was there always a sense of sort of anarchy?
Was a loose cannon.
Mm.
Everett was very easy to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Kenny used to say, people expect me to come in the room turning cartwheels. He was a very quiet man, off. Very quiet in real life.
Yeah.
Quite shy. So he wasn't mad. He could play mad, but he wasn't. Freddie was the real thing.
Yeah. I mean, did you enjoy collaborating, if you like, with Kenny Everett? Did he work with you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Very happy time.
Did you write together, or did you sort of throw ideas?
No, Kenny never wrote. Ray Cameron and I, as I said, wrote the scripts, and Kenny would bring something to them. As soon as you created a character, he knew what to do with it.
Mm, certainly did, didn't he? Is it Cupid?
Cupid stunt, yeah.
Wonderful. Of course, moving on to today, as you say, it seems today there are so many topical panel shows with comedians and shows like Mock the Week and Have I Got News For You. But you regularly appear on I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue in just a minute. What do you think it is about Sorry I Haven't
a
Clue that endures?
No, I used to appear on Just a Minute, but you see, understandably, don't want you all over the place.
Yes.
So I'm a sort of understudy, sub on the bench, if somebody drops out of Just a Minute. But no, it's mainly Sorry I Haven't a Clue, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you think it is about that show that really endures?
We don't know. If we ever find out, the game's over.
You're going to keep those TV gold secrets to yourself then?
No one analyzes it. No, thank you.
Absolutely. I mean, do you ever feel a bit odd, or should I say oddy, wedged between two goodies like Tim Brooke Taylor and Graham Garden?
I never think of them like that. No. They're just two of my oldest friends, over 40 years.
Lovely. It's nice, isn't it, to work with people who have become such good friends?
Well, it's like telepathy. You never butt in on each other. You sort of know what each other's thinking, you know.
Definitely. Well, like you've said in your book, it hasn't been so much a career move, but more a series of incidents and a vague plan to make a
That's
living
right.
you loved.
That's right.
It's kind of an incredible incident, though, isn't it? I mean, what have been personal highlights for you? It's a big question.
What highlights?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know. Working with, being unpatriotic, working with American greats like Jack Benny and Bob Hope and George Burns. I work with Richard Pryor is on my CV.
Yes.
That always surprises people. Yeah, I worked with him at Elstree in the 70s, and he was, here we go again, absolutely delightful.
Mm-hmm.
And then a madman on stage.
Yes. So he's actually quite sort of maybe quiet off stage, was he? Not quite so...
Yeah, they're saving their energy.
Good plan, isn't it? Brilliant. It's been lovely. It's been such a joy.
It's been a pleasure.
It has been a real joy to talk to you, Barry. A complete legend. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Bye-bye now. And that was Barry Cryer, OBE.